Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity.
Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right.
That's right. That's right. We are going to do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And this is the show where we bring you folks who are on that battlefield. And they are fighting on many battlefields. They're fighting on for health care, police accountability, housing, education. And in fact, our guest today is going to be talking about education and literacy. So we can't wait to get to that. I first want to remind you that if you miss a show or if you want to hear a show again, you can go to JamalaRogers.com and you can find them as well as various articles that have been written. And I'm doing that now because I'm supposed to do it at the end of the program, but oftentimes we are in such animated discussion, then we either run out of time or I forget. So I'm going to do that at the top. You can always see or hear these programs at JamalaRogers.com. Today, we're going to have a guest who is all about education. Ian Buchanan is, I think you've had so many roles as an educator. You've been a teacher, you've been a principal, you've been a assistant superintendent. Now you have your own organization called NEA. Education named after your baby girl. Of course, she's not a baby anymore. And in fact, I think she's an educator as well, right?
Absolutely, yes. She is an educator. And the organization, and so I wouldn't say that the organization is named after her. I would say that my daughter is named after the Key Swahili concept, and so is the business. There is myself and about five of my friends who intentionally decided that we want to name our first daughters Nia. So,
Wow. So we got a, we got five Nias around here. And Nia,
absolutely.
For those folks who don't know, is purpose. So if you name that, you from day one, you were put on the path to do something righteous. So, oh, wow. And, you know, you are a native of East Boogie. And I think
that's
people
right.
ought to know that because you, you know, really have been just all around, even though you, in my eyes, you are a young man. But I think you've just packed in just so much in your short life. So thank you for coming and joining us today.
Thank you, Jamala, Mama Jamala. And before we get started, you know, I have to just give you your roses. I know this is not something that you are desirous of, but I just want to thank you for being one of those people who helped me see what leadership in our community is supposed to be like, what a grounded, egoless, focus on the prize, approaching and trying to disrupt this system of inequality and racism and xenophobia that we have. And so I just want to publicly thank you for being somebody that I've been looking up to and been guided by since I was in my early 20s. And I'll be 54 in a couple days. So thank you so much.
Well, happy birthday, Kuzaliwa Faraha. And wow, 54. Ian, come on now. You making me old. Because I remember when you didn't have gray in your beard.
That's right.
I remember when you didn't have a beard. Yeah, you're a clean-shaven young man. Yeah. So this is such an interesting topic for me, and I'm going to put my hat as an educator today. But last year we had guest on that talked about the ban the books. We had somebody from the ACLU. We also had a librarian from out of Ohio who's, you know, really been fighting to make sure we have books available. And then here we are, you know, with this whole literacy issue. And so not only are we fighting to keep books, particularly books about Black people, accessible, we are trying to make sure that our children can read those books. So it just seemed to me to be appropriate to have you, when I first heard about the whole Right to Read initiative, I'm like, okay, yeah, we got to hear more about that. So tell us, yeah, what is the genesis of, and I know we're not the only ones doing this in St. Louis, so tell us a bit about why people thought it was necessary, where it started, why people thought it was necessary.
Yes, so I jumped into this work a little bit before Thanksgiving to help the NAACP, the St. Louis City and County chapters of the NAACP move this Right to Read initiative forward. And it really started in Oakland, California, where a gentleman by the name of Kareem Weaver started to ring the alarm. And he started to say, hey, this is an issue writ large across, you know, demographics. However, like we know, when white America is sick, Black America has pneumonia, the flu-monia, COVID,
on their deathbed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of those issues that is particularly acutely impacting Black students. And so the NAACP, St. Louis City and St. Louis County said, we understand that this is an issue. And so we know we don't have the answer. However, we want to be part of the solution. And so that is really how the work got started. They tapped me, like I said, right before Thanksgiving or so, and said, hey, we got this work that we want to do. We're not exactly sure what it's going to look like. This is a generative process. We need to get the community involved. And Ian, can you quarterback this? And with me being a person who understands that literacy is life, I was like, yes, let's make this happen.
Wow. So one of the things that I think has been troubling for me over the years is the fact that the reading levels of Black children keep dipping and dipping and dipping. And I know that, you know, there's lots of reasons for that. But I think for me, when a Black child says openly and honestly that they hate reading, that just, you know, motivates me to do what else can I do? Because this child, not only I want them to share my love for reading, but I know that reading is an essential skill that you have to have in life. If you can't read, you're not going to be able to navigate through this, you know, complex system very effectively. And so they're already going to be behind in so many different ways. The whole non-reading piece, I know that LeVar Burton has talked about this, but it's interesting. Every time I think about LeVar Burton heading up this whole literacy thing, which he's been doing for a while, I think about he played Kunta Kinte, a slave who could not read or write, at least, you know, mm-hmm. in English. And out of that came this whole thing where now he's the face of literacy. And so I just think that's so ironic. But here's how he explains it. This whole notion, at some point, somebody got this great idea, which I know happens in education as you do. Somebody's got this new curriculum, this new whatever, the latest little fad. And this whole thing about kicking phonics out and doing whole language or pictures or whatever, he's pointing to that as the real crux of the reading crisis that we have. Is that the way you're looking at it as well?
Absolutely. I think that is one of the primary problems. And I also think that that is the problem that actually activated the soccer moms. And so this issue, so there has been this pendulum swing, Mama Jamala, where, you know, for me growing up, Sesame Street, Electric Company, the letter people, all of those things, that's phonics and that's phonemic awareness. Mm-hmm. And that is how many of us actually learn how to read. Mm-hmm. However, there has been this pendulum swing that he talks about, and it's this thing around whole language. And basically what happened is these soccer moms said, hey, we're investing all of this money, all of this time, all of this energy into our children, and we find out that they cannot read. Why is that? And so what happened is there was Balanced Literacy offers a grandiose vision of students falling in love with reading. Reading is not like learning how to speak. You don't necessarily have to be taught to learn how to speak and to understand language. However, teaching reading is a very explicit science. And some people say it's not rocket science. It's actually much harder. And so this is where, this is one of the things that contributes to this gap that we see. It's not the only thing, but it is a primary impediment to kids not being able to read, especially students who look like you and me.
So why has it taken us so long, and I'm saying us collectively, particularly in the education field, to see that that methodology, that particular pedagogy was not working, and not just for black kids, but for most kids? Because if you have a child read to you and, you know, they struggle with a sentence and you kind of help them with the words, if they understood phonetics and they could sound out those words and pretty much get it themselves, but then they could come to the same word in the next sentence and not know what that word is. And, and you know, people say, well, what's wrong with this kid? And I've heard parents say, you know, was here when I think you make a diagnosis and you say this is the reason, and you take the blame and the stigma off the children, the teachers, parents, then we can all begin to look at, okay, where do we go from here? As opposed to say, the reason little Johnny can't read is because little Johnny is dumb, stupid, or won't sit in his seat or whatever. When the method that we chose to use to help him read does not work for him or any of the other students that you're doing. I don't really know who it would work for. Because at a certain point, you got to learn how to sound out words, even if you're looking at somebody's name that you don't know. So I think when, how are you all going to incorporate that particular bit of knowledge into the initiative?
So you know, one of the things that I love about the NAACP is that NAACP can use the carrot, but we can also use the stick. And so part of this is that we have to demand that our institutions of higher ed, we have to demand that our State Department of Education, that they are ensuring that, first, let's talk about higher ed first, that we are ensuring that these pre-service teachers are deeply trained in what we call the science of reading. And I say that sounds like a duh to most people, but there are many higher ed institutions that are putting out teacher candidates who don't understand this methodology and cannot transfer it to what it looks like in a classroom. So I think that's one thing. And then I think the other piece is, when we talk about schools, we, the NAACP, we do not take this approach of blame, shame, and guilt. We're not guilting the parents. We're not guilting the community. We're not guilting teachers. What we're saying is, this is broken, and so how do we fix it? And so at the school-based level, or at the district level, or LEA, whatever you want to call it, it is ensuring that teachers have the right instructional materials. But not only do they need the right instructional materials, but they need the right methodologies to teach the students in the class. You can't teach all students the same way. So this issue of culturally responsive teaching, that is teaching that meets the needs and the cultures of those students, is important. Another part of that is cultural competency. You actually have to know and respect the cultural capital that our kids bring to the table. And so those are two parts. So I think that part of it is making sure that the institutions of higher ed are training teachers properly. Part of it is ensuring that teachers have the resources that they need, the instructional methods that they need, and the time to actually process. We call it intellectual prep. So the time to actually, it's almost like somebody reading a script one time as an actor and being able to be Denzel. It's not going to happen. So teachers need the time to do that. And so those are a couple of the major issues that we face. There are so many other issues that are related to this. This really is a multi-layer, complex issue. However, it's one that can be solved. And we are committed to helping to solve it.
So I think the last thing that you said about giving educators the time to do this work? Because oftentimes, and you know this from being a teacher, you get stuff put on top of what you're already doing, and nothing comes off the table. Everything gets packed on, and at a certain point, either teachers don't do any of it or do their own thing or some adaptation of it, or they pick and choose. And so this may be the thing that does not get chosen, and that would be most unfortunate for our kids. But it seems like the other thing about time, and I, you know, was trying to promote this when I was in the St. Louis Public Schools, is just being able to have time for collegiality with your fellow teachers, so that you could talk about ideas, so that you could share, you know, a suggestion, you can share a workshop that you went to. They don't have time for that either. So sometimes even what you're talking about, Ian, gets done in a vacuum, because that, you know, I'm going to do my thing. I guess I'll go, you know, to the teacher's lounge, or I'll stay in my room. But how about the sort of interaction that you would have between folks who are going to be doing the same thing you do? And it's just not there, at least not in public schools. Maybe it's there in private schools or parochial schools. But I know that's one of the things that's burning our teachers out, and we're going through a lot of them. I've had folks on the show talking about, you know, the burnout of Black teachers and the exodus of, you know, Black teachers from this profession when we need them so desperately to either be a part of, you know, challenges like this. So you've been also a principal. You've seen, you know, how these systems operate. How do you see teaching teachers how to teach this particular area?
Yes, I think part of it is what you alluded to, and that is removing barriers. And so when you talk about the time for teachers to have collegiality, to do what we call intellectual prep, many times it's done in what they call professional learning communities. But, you know, now one of the things that we're faced with high student absences and high teacher absences. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a third grade teacher, if there's another fourth grade teacher out that day, I may have to use my intellectual prep time to actually substitute in that classroom. Mm-hmm. And this work is so intense. For example, the primary strategy that the state uses to ensure that these teachers are really can embrace the science of reading is a training that they call letters training. Letters training is the equivalent of a 6-hour college course. And so teachers need time to receive the training, to do the practicing, to get the coaching, and to make sure that they have the high quality stuff that they need to make it happen. And so many times either the training is subpar, or there are so many different obstacles in the way. So I think those are a couple of things that stand in the way for teachers to really be able to do this. The other thing is, hey, teaching is a stressful job. Hmm. And so when we talk about
even under the best of circumstances.
Absolutely. And so when we talk about the social, emotional, the wellness and the stuff like that, that impacts us as well. If I'm not well, I can't be well for my babies. You know, Jamala, my daughter left St. Louis and she moved to Atlanta, and she taught for 7 years. Then she got burned out. And so she walked away from the game after 7 years. Mm. She's a young, she hadn't even hit 30 yet before she got out the game. Mm. And just because it was so much stress, especially during COVID. Mm. And so one of the things that we know that is starting to show traction or starting to know progress is this concept of extended school years. Mm-hmm. So maybe kids are in class 4 days a week, and on the fifth day, they do some kind of experiential learning experience at the Missouri Botanical Garden, at the Boys and Girls Club, at the Science Center, and teachers have a chance to reset, recalibrate, plan, have some collegial relationships. So that's one of the ways that some schools are moving towards a solution, is this extended day. So again, it could be 4-day work week, a 4-day could be 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off. But all of these different kinds of reconfigurations are things that we have to think about. The other thing we got to think about is the science of reading is such a challenge, but at the elementary level, you want an elementary teacher to be a master at mathematics, science, English, social studies. And so what we're arguing is that maybe we should consider doing the departmentalization just as they do at the middle school and secondary level. Maybe we should consider having one or two teachers that are super specialized in literacy and they take all of the literacy students in the third grade versus them having to prep for three or four different classes. How about if we just have a laser-like focus on literacy?
Wow.
So those are just a couple of things. You know, I can go on and on.
I know, because what you made me think about is I can recall, you know, when you got high school students who basically can't read, their 10th, 11th, 12th grade, and I can recall making a suggestion to the principal that maybe what we could do for the young people who absolutely can't read is it's almost what you just suggested. Put them into a class where they get taught how to read. It wouldn't be called a reading class, because you know how it is when you gonna get that label on you. But it would be something very exciting and imaginative and creative that they would want to go, and then folks would be saying, other students like, how do you get in that class? I could not get these folks to be visionary enough, to be bold enough to do that kind of thing. So, you know, we got generations of young people who can't read now. But I'm thinking of, as you talked about all the various levels, how is this initiative going to look? Because you went all the way to teacher ed schools. You know, how is this going to look on all of those levels? What's the challenges?
So, you know, I want to touch on what you said, you know, kind of talking about the secondary, you know, the secondary level. You're right. Some kids are going to leave third grade. Some kids have left third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, and they're reading two or three or four levels behind. And so there are some efforts now to do more specialization to support kids at the middle school level and the high school level with some of those foundational skills. Is that happening everywhere? No, but it is starting to happen more. I think that's one thing. And can you repeat your question again? I want to make sure I hit it right.
No, so when you talk about all the different levels that impact reading, starting all the way to teacher education schools, what is this initiative going to look like?
Yeah, and so the first thing that we did, so probably over the last 8 weeks, I probably had 40, 50 conversations with the Missouri Department of Ed, superintendents, board members, teachers, literacy coaches, literacy adjacent organizations, parents, parent organizations, dyslexia organizations, researchers, institutes of higher education, to understand the depth of the problem, to try to understand what some of the gaps are, to understand where it's happening, where the work is happening. And so the first thing that we want to do is to pull together this kind of comprehensive landscape analysis, SWOT analysis, whatever you want to call it, in order to understand the depth of the problem. And so we're starting to see, when we bring all of these different voices together, we're starting to see even more clearly what some of the challenges are. For example, right after the Right to Read viewing that we had maybe a couple of weeks ago, the very next day we had breakfast with superintendents, most of the higher education institutions in the St. Louis area, literacy folks, early childhood folks, the Missouri Department of Education, to give them an opportunity to have some conversation around a common table. And it's very rare that all of these different stakeholder groups actually get a chance to talk together in the same space. Mm. And so even out of that, we were able to see some things that are working, but we were able to see some tremendous cracks in the system that are really leading to this underperformance that we see. And so I think part of it is listening. You cannot solve a problem if you're not listening to the people that are most closely impacted by the problem. Mm. And that's one of the things that we are clear about. You don't do for us and to us, do it with us. Mm. And so that's kind of the way that we're moving the ball forward.
Well, what kind of response did you get from those stakeholders?
Oh, man. Some were, yeah, we're doing a lot of this stuff, and here's what we need. Yeah, we're doing a lot of this stuff. Maybe we could do more. Oh, no, actually, we're not doing some of these things. For example, there are several universities in our region, like I may have mentioned, that are not committed to the science of reading. So they're pumping 20, 30, 40 teachers out who don't know what the hell they're doing. And so they get into our classrooms and use our kids as experiments. And then they move on to other places where they might be more successful. The other thing is that we're pulling out data. For example, some of these more affluent school districts in the St. Louis region, mostly West County, many of them are not fully committed to this methodology that worked, and the test scores of their black students are not just moving slowly, they're actually moving backwards. Mm. And so part of this is to ring the alarm to say, you can't hide no more. We see you. So now what? And I think the NAACP, St. Louis City, St. Louis County, just as Oakland did, is going to have to offer carrots. So that might be additional funding for extra tutoring. That might be advocacy at the state level or advocacy at the national level, but also use a stick to say, hey, university, if you're not grounded in the science of reading and you are not believing in this, we're just not going to hire any of your teachers. Hmm. So I think it's going to have to be a combination of carrot and stick. So support and accountability. I think those two are both important.
Well, you mentioned some of the stakeholders and you're talking about the county. So what's the geographical area of the initiative? It sounds pretty big.
Well, yeah. So right now, this work is St. Louis City and St. Louis County. There's an acute need in St. Charles County, too. And so we may eventually work in that area. But right now, our focus is St. Louis City, St. Louis County, because that's where the majority of black students in the region are. And we're not differentiating between traditional public and public charter, because our students are in all of those schools. Right now, we have not taken a focus at the privates and parochials, but that will also be one of the next steps that we're thinking about, too, because we have a number of our students in those organizations as well. And we can learn from those institutions if they have things that are working well.
And I know that sometimes charter schools have lured parents away from the public schools, saying, you know, we do better and we do better with test scores, when in fact they have not. And so I'm glad that you all are including them in this process, because I'm like you, wherever our children are, whether they be in parochial, charter, whatever, we need to be concerned about their learning and their achievement. So this whole thing about, and I really want to know where y'all got the markers for this. You all are saying you're going to have fourth graders reading at proficiency level by 2030. Now, I'm going to remind you, that's 6 years away. So how is that going to be done? This is such a humongous initiative.
Yeah, so the goal that has been articulated by the NAACP, and I think a couple of the news articles have it just a little bit incorrect. So we know that you cannot have any kind of, you can, but you should not set a goal without putting some numbers behind it, without something being measurable. And we want to make sure that in order to keep the momentum going, that we have something that's actually attainable. And so what it takes to ensure that, and I want to state this first, this is an extremely low bar. So this is not the destination. This is a milestone along the journey. Mm. So what the data shows us is that in the third grade, so let's just take Hazelwood, for example. If in every third grade classroom, we could increase the number of students that are proficient, if we can increase that number by two students per year, let me say it again, if we can increase the number of students who are reading proficiently, one or two students per year in every classroom, then in essence, we will have eliminated the gap between the state and the performance of black students. Right now, around 20% of black students in our region are reading proficiently. The state average is 40%. So we're saying as an initial step, we can close that gap by setting some deliberate goals around that. But it's not just enough to set goals, because if we could solve this problem easily, we would have solved it a long time ago. So that's why we want to try to understand who's doing it well, what are some of the gaps, how can NAACP be a convener and provide carrots and sticks to move the ball forward. And so, again, that is, in my opinion, it's not the destination. It's a milestone, but it hasn't been done yet. So why not use that? And so that is one of the kind of initial ways that we're going to be able to track. But I will say this as the last thing about that. When you go to affluent schools and when you go to like some of the Montessori schools, they don't really talk about the MAP score or which is a high stakes a Missouri State assessment. They don't really talk about the MAP test or these other assessments because they know that if they do the right thing, then they're going to knock those scores out of the water. Mm-hmm. So my argument is that if we do the right thing, this little bitty goal we got is going to be child's play. We're going to knock this out and even more. And I also want to say that white people aren't the bar. They don't represent excellence because they ain't reading either. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to use a D plus or an F minus as our bar. We just say that is a milestone.
Wow. So if you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host with Voices from the Battlefield. And I am talking to Ian Buchanan, who is heading up the Right to Read initiative for this region. And Ian, when we talk about the fourth grade, when I first saw that, I was one, it always comes to mind, like, Kwanzaa Kujufu's book around the conspiracy to destroy black boys, because we know by the time they get to third and fourth grade, they basically have lost interest in education just because of the way that they've been treated, for those three grades ahead of time. I think maybe in the kindergarten they might enjoy school, but after that it's like, there's just a turnoff. So is fourth grade for you all, why you pick fourth grade as opposed to seventh grade, some of the data that shows that, young people, particularly black boys, start really just falling back and retreating from education?
Yeah, so our focus is actually third grade and not fourth grade, but it's still the same reason. We do know that, one of these theories is that pre-K through three, students are learning to read. Three on beyond, they're reading to learn. So the premise is that if we teach students how to read and also infuse the joy of reading, infuse joy in classrooms, make sure that students see themselves and see others in books. We talk about windows and mirrors, that we will be able to make some traction. And so that's why we use third grade as a marker. Mm-hmm. And I will just say, as a principal, so I was a principal in Pine Line, which is the Normandy School District. I was a principal in St. Louis Public. I was an assistant superintendent in U-City. I was a teacher in Ferguson, Florissant, and a principal in Ferguson, Florissant. And I can tell you, as an elementary principal, go to a kindergarten classroom. You get all the hugs, the love, mm-hmm. the joy. First and second grade, the same thing. Third grade, the same thing-ish. Mm-hmm. By the time they get to fourth grade, third grade, fourth grade, you start to see it drop off. Mm-hmm. And you can see the energy in classrooms. Mm-hmm. And I can't even tell you how many times I've cried over this. This is an issue that makes you want to cry fight at the same time.
It does.
But you know what? I'm locked in. As you know about East St. Louis, we don't play. And so I'm locked in and I'm committed 100% to trying to make this happen. Yeah, we're not going to do things perfect. Like I said before, like Martin Luther King said, we are public servants, not perfect servants. Mm. But we know that we got to fight for our babies because they deserve it.
Absolutely. I'm thinking also about, and you got to think about this, even as lofty as the goals are, what the price tag would be on an initiative like this. Like, I saw where, for example, in Michigan, the governor finally is going to release something like 90-something million dollars that came out of a lawsuit because the children in those districts were failing in Detroit. So do we have, like, big funds like that, like $94 million that we can say is going to go towards raising the bar for these kids or any kind of funding that, because when we look at the public schools themselves, whether they be county or city, they all crying broke. And so what are we doing about the funding part of this?
Well, so my brother, who his birth name was Lassane Crooks, but we know him as Tupac. He said, we got money for war, but we can't feed the poor. And so when we think about all of the ways that we find money, we can find money to put people in prison. We can find this money. Mm. But it's going to take a couple different things. We have to rethink the way that schools are funded. That's number one. To support school, for the primary funding source to be personal property taxes or to be property taxes is in itself inequitable. So that's number one. Mm. The second thing is, yes, the state and the federal government need to rededicate and recommit funds, and some of that is happening. But I think also that's where our funding community comes in. That's where our philanthropic folks come in as well, because we all got to have our hand on the wheel about this. And so I think that if we want to think about this as a health crisis, if we want to think about this as a human rights issue, if we want to think about this as a civil rights issue, whatever we got to do to ring the alarm, if we want to think about it as, all right, this is the little guy that's going to be jacking your car or breaking into your house, or you're not going to be able to find employees. So we can hit you from the moral perspective. We can hit you from the community wellness perspective. We can hit you from the economic perspective. Whatever way you want to look at it, it is a worthy investment. And so that's my argument. So we can find the money. We can find the money for everything else.
Well, I agree. I agree. And I'm also thinking about I can't think of the name of the report that was done maybe 3 or 4 years ago that Dr. Jason Purnell helped to pull together. But I think one of the it'll come to me in a minute. One of the things that was so crystal clear about that report as it relates to education is when you don't have it, there are so many obstacles and deterrents that keep you from living a full life. So immediately, you know, your earnings are not going to be the same. Your ability to thrive health-wise is not the same. So it was like all the health all the education indicators were directly related to people's health and well-being. And I'm thinking if folks don't see these connections, then I really don't know what to say. I really don't.
Yeah. You're talking about the for the sake of all.
Yes, for the sake of all.
Yeah, no, I agree. All of these things are interconnected, as almost everything is in society, right?
Mm-hmm.
So education is one of those areas that we see these gross inequities. This one is impacting some of the most vulnerable, precious gifts in our community, which is our young people. In essence, let's just say this, that in life, people have 100 doors that are open. By the time that many of our babies reach the kindergarten, 70 of those doors are already closed.
Exactly.
Because they come in with vocabulary gaps. Mm-hmm. And then you walk into some of our schools. And again, this is not to indict schools, because I got blood on my hands more than most people. So this is not to indict our schools, but to also say that we need some support so we can better serve. And I call it, you know, we got BC and PC. Before COVID, post-COVID. Mm. Post-COVID is a beast. PC is a beast.
Mm.
And it impacts our children. It impacts the adults. It impacts our community, especially those students who were in pre-K, kindergarten, first and second grade, right around 2020, 2021.
Wow. You know, I had a roundtable of educators from around the country talk about teaching during COVID and the challenges with that. And most admitted that they had very little support during COVID to teach, even though there was some very rough times. But I'm also looking at some questions that have come to me that I don't really know how to respond. Has there been any research in terms of how far behind our children got as a result of COVID? Because I know people talking about, yeah, they got computers to take home. Half of them didn't use the computers. There was nobody home to help them with the computers. So those couple of years for a lot of folks were just a wash. But have we done some real scientific survey that says, here's how many years these kids are behind, and this is what we're going to have to do to get them caught up?
Yeah, there has been a lot of significant research around the impact, the unexpected repercussions or whatever of COVID. So, yeah, there have been. And I think some people would argue that we are back to where we were post-COVID. So we might be from F minus, we might be at an F plus now. Yeah, there has been a lot of research around that, and there have been recommendations about strategies that we can use to try to continue to accelerate learning, to accelerate student process. One of the things that has really changed or has been, elevated since COVID is the need for social emotional supports, well-being supports, mm-hmm. therapeutic supports for both students and families. I talked to one superintendent maybe two or three weeks ago, and I said, what is the biggest issue that you face? And she said, many of our lower elementary students just are dysregulated. They have not figured out how to do school yet. Mm. And so part of that is, you know, due to COVID.
Well, the other thing that we found out during COVID is, you know, the mental health of our children deteriorated, as it has for most adults. And I think the most alarming thing came out, the suicide rates increased during COVID for, you know, black teens and black boys. So when we're talking about something as elementary as reading, and then you have these other challenges, I'm wondering how we get to the end goal, or at least get a process going, when, first of all, you have teachers that need some readiness, and then you have students that need some readiness. So what is being going to be done in between there to get young people ready to read?
Yeah, so so social scientists have this term called the wicked problem. And a wicked problem is basically a problem that has not been solved. And many other solutions can even seem contradictory. And it's very hard to find even agreement on what the solution is. In many ways, this is a wicked problem. It is a problem that has... So as part of my conversation with these 40 or 50 people that I talked to, I asked, what is your theory of change? What do you think is going to take to move the needle forward? If I talked to 50 people, I probably got about 70 different theories of change. Mm. So everybody has their theories about what needs to change. We need to give the kids black books. We need to extend the school day. And so I think that there are a combination of things that show promise, but like anything else, part of it is the execution. So, yeah, so we know that high-quality materials work. We know that teachers being trained in the science of reading works. We know that that our students need not just the cognitive stuff, but they need the affective stuff. They need to see themselves. They need to have a sense of belonging. They need to have high expectations. We also know that we need to confront some of these stereotypes and prejudices that many of our teachers have against our students, whether the teacher be black, white, or brown. Because we breathe the smog of racism just like everybody else does. We haven't been holding our breath for 400 years. We've been breathing this up too. And so the universities have to do their part. DESE has to do its part. The community, families, we have to find ways to better empower our families. I will say that, you know, we are seeing efforts move forward within the St. Louis region. We just have to continue to make sure that they're aligned. If there's duplication, we have to try to eliminate unnecessary duplication if we can. And I definitely want to applaud St. Louis Public Schools for the literacy and the LU activity that they had this past weekend. Well attended, lots of resources, so many families out despite the weather. So I think efforts like that, efforts like what we're doing with the NAACP and other efforts, are just part of the solution. But there is no if this, then that. This problem is way more complicated than that. But again, I think the root of it, in E.M. Buchanan's opinion, in the book of E.M. Buchanan, part of it is finding ways to interrupt inequity. In my book, I call it slashing the tires of white supremacy. And so part of this is grounded in these white supremacist ideologies that black kids don't deserve this anyway.
And they can't learn. Why bother?
Exactly. And what about the parents? Mm-hmm. And what about the teachers? And what about the communities? No, what about this system that's broken?
So, E.M., when you talked about all the different opinions about the problem, and then also all the different opinions about the solution, the things that you pointed out were definitely data-driven and data-informed. So is that the way that this initiative is going to move, that it's not going to be based on somebody's opinion? We're looking at hard and fast data. And then I want you to talk about some of the places where the right to read is going on and what we can learn from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, we're definitely looking at data. I mean, I have so much right now. It's just incredible. So, for example, we have all of the data that says if we're going to reach this goal by 2030, this is how many proficient students we have in, let's just say, Francis Howell School District. No, let's not use Francis Howell.
Please, please.
No. So for example, we have the data right now that says this is how many students are proficient at each school in the Ferguson-Florissant School District. And if they move X amount of kids per year by 2030, this is how many kids it's going to take. So we have that data. We have data broken down by, okay, what is Parkway doing with all of their students? More specifically, what are they doing with black students? So we have all kind of data, and we will continue to track data. And one of the things we want to do is recognize successes. And I'm going to get to your question in just a second. We want to recognize teachers and schools and grade levels and districts that are having growth, because growth is important. If I'm in the sixth grade and you move me in a course of a year, if I'm reading a second grade level and you, by the end of the year, you move me to the fifth grade level, you move me three levels in a year, that's progress. Mm-hmm. We have to recognize that. We also have to recognize people who meet the bar of proficiency. So we can't just talk about proficiency, because it's not fair to not recognize growth. Mm-hmm. And so now one of the things that you talked about was who's doing this right. So there are a couple of states that are really making progress, and I'm pleased to say that DESE has been working alongside the state of Mississippi, because Mississippi was one of those ones who was the most disinvested, the most struggling academically, and they have made some significant strides. And so DESE is figuring out and working alongside them as a learner. And so they are bringing some of those learnings back. The state of Delaware is doing that as well. And so what we want to do as an NAACP is we want to take cohorts to visit these places. We want to have study conversations with these places. We want to use them as exemplars so we can decide what works in St. Louis and our region and what doesn't. And so part of our work over the next couple of, at least by June, July, is to really think about what does it mean for us to take groups to visit, for Mississippi to come here, for us to do some really intense work, sharing staff, doing whatever we need to do. Because again, there are some places that are getting it right. As a matter of fact, I'll be going to Delaware. We'll be taking a cohort of people to Delaware in about 3 weeks to take a look at what they're doing. So we are looking at models. And Oakland is also moving the needle forward. And part of that is because they didn't say, excuse me, Mr. State Department of Education, can you do this? They said, no. These are eight demands that we have, and y'all going to get it done.
Mm. And that includes, you know, that kind of boldness means that they had a community behind them, that they had already prepped to say, here's what's happening, here's what we need, here's where your tax dollars are, let's go get them.
Yeah. And you know, one thing that you know and Brother Percy know is he's like multi-interest, like creating a movement based on shared problem, but like multiracial, multi-ethnic, like, these soccer moms are getting pissed off about this dyslexia issue. And they are suing districts. They are raising hell. And dyslexia is an issue that cuts across race, class, gender. But it's one that is impacting so many students. And the majority of black men who are in prison have a dyslexia issue.
Well, we know they definitely have a reading issue, but yes. Related to dyslexia, right?
Absolutely.
And we won't even talk about, you know, lead poisoning that leads to learning disabilities as to why they're there. So, yeah, so that's why when I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking about all the multi layers, it is complex, but I think you've adequately said that it's not impossible for us to see some growth. So how can the public get involved in this? I mean, we talked about, you know, teachers and administrators and officials. What can people do to support this? Are we into buying books? Or, you know, what can the average person that's listening to this broadcast do?
Yeah, I would say that there are many seats on the bus, and people need to determine what seat on the bus works for them. For example, if you're a parent, would you join organizations like Bridge to Hope or Activate STL, or would you tap into them for support? And we talked about ways to ensure that families are more clear about where their child is in terms of their reading grade level equivalency. So is it that you ask some very specific questions to your child's teacher about literacy? Is it that you join the NAACP? Is it that you come to these meetings, or is it that you show when we go to the legislator to advocate for things? So there are so many different ways that folks can jump in. I say just, stay tuned to what the NAACP is doing, what other orgs are doing. We'll definitely be having broad communications. And so we want to invite people to get in where they fit in. Even if it's just saying, like, for example, I got a call yesterday from a family where I as an NAACP education chair, from a family that needed some one-on-one advocacy. Mm-hmm. That's one way. If you feel like your child might be getting underserved, tap into us. Mm-hmm. And if we can support, we can kind of lead you into ways. So again, there are multiple, and to spread the word that, hey, there's a literacy issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that families can do is read to their children. Mm-hmm. Like, there are just so many different ways that people can get in to this work. I would say this, one of the simplest things that families can do all across the country, Jamala, there is a chronic absentee issue. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I do is get our babies to school.
Mm-hmm.
We also
Look what's there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we got to make them want to come to school.
We got to make them want to come to school and have something there that's, exciting and innovative when they come, not some damn ditto sheets.
Exactly right. Exactly. And they have to feel, again, a sense of belonging, a sense of tough love. We call it the warm demander. We need to have warm demanders in the classroom. And you think about warm, we're loving, we're compassionate. But you think about demanding, we're not going to let you fail. Mm-hmm. You're not going to fail on my watch.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to have this archetype. I call it the old school East St. Louis teacher is what I call it. Miss Lillian Williams, Miss Parsons, Mr. McKinney, Mr. Fields.
You know what, though, and maybe you can help me balance this out, but I was a big advocate of reading to kids. I can't tell you how many schools I went into reading to the kids. But now, I'm thinking maybe that was not such a good thing unless there were going to be a reading program, because I'm thinking, okay, I'm reading to them, I'm getting them excited about reading. They pick up a book and they can't do anything with it. They're just looking at pictures. What? Help me with that.
So that is just one piece of the solution is reading aloud, because what that does is that encourages what we call oral comprehension, so they can comprehend. It may also expand their vocabulary. It may expand their backgrounds of experiences. It may help them with verbal reasoning and things like that. So there's a place for that. It is not the answer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, reading to kids is important, especially if you're reading a text that may be above their grade level. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is one of the areas, but that is not a solution. And I think part of it is that some people thought that if this, then that. Mm-hmm. If we do this, then that's going to eliminate it. And mm-hmm. so that is one of the strategies that has an impact, but it doesn't have a high impact.
Mm.
Well, it's part of the process.
And I think, when folks see the joy that you have of reading, oftentimes it is contagious. I mean, that's how I got interested in reading as a kid. Other folks was doing it. I want to do it too. So it's just a fascinating field. And I think when you refer to it as the science of teaching reading, that's really what it is. And I think we have been dismissive about what it takes to get kids to read.
Yeah. Like I said, in order, and so again, there's this, so the state is expecting early elementary teachers to be grounded in the science of reading. And one of the ways they do that is through a training that is called letters training. I forgot what the acronym means. But going through letters training is the equivalent of a 6-credit-hour class. Mm. And it is extremely rigorous. Mm. And so to expect teachers to be able to be teachers, to have families, to have a life outside of school,
mm-hmm.
then to be an and some of these teachers are potentially taking classes as well, and then expect me to be an expert in math, science,
mm-hmm.
social studies, reading, and then to be a mama, an auntie, a brother, a cousin, a therapist, and then to sit in these meetings for professional development. You're asking a lot of teachers, and you're undervaluing me with your pay.
Right. And even the respect. You know, some folks will say, okay, maybe I'm not making money, but damn, at least respect me for what I'm doing. Respect this profession. So,
and you know this, just real quick, you know this too, Jamala. Most teachers tell their kids, don't be no teacher.
yeah. We talked about that too. And hence you have people not going into the teaching profession. And then I had, brother, Abdul Muhammad, who is, you know, being, persecuted up there in Chicago, had him talking about his situation where even sometimes when teachers are doing good things for their kids doesn't mean that that's going to mean they stay or get respected. And so all of these different battles that are going on to be a teacher sometimes is just overwhelming.
Absolutely. And you're right, though. You know, those people, I know brother Abdul, that's Niambi's husband.
Yep.
Uh-huh. You know, sometimes when you take a stand, as it with anything, you get ostracized.
Exactly.
You get demonized.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start to think, am I crazy or is everybody else crazy?
Yeah, I thought I was standing up for my kids and my their families. And lo and behold, here's all this wicked stuff coming at you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think so then, you know, we have to decide whether we're going to, you know, what the brain tells us to do, whether we're going to engage in fight or we're going to engage in flight. And that's kind of the choices that we have to make. And you know, I mean, I've been in education. I started teaching high school in 1995. I've never had a job over 5 years. And part of it is because there are times when I've gotten disillusioned.
Mm-hmm. And you got to step back and get rejuvenated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. In our last few minutes, Eon, can you talk about the big national screening and how people can get hooked into that? So February 1st, kicking off, you know, Black History Month, there's going to be a national screening. How do people register for that?
You can definitely contact us at the NAACP office to find out more about that. To be very honest, I don't know all of the details for that, but I know you can contact the NAACP office for that. Or you can call, or you can, you know, text or email me. It would probably be best to email me at educationchair@stlouisnaacp.org. educationchair@stlouisnaacp.org. But again, you can contact the NAACP office and we'll be able to share that information with you. I do want to say something about the video. I want to add a caveat. And because Ian Buchanan, has never been a groupthink person. My parents didn't raise me that way. A couple things I want to say about the movie that are okay, but that some may find problematic. One is when they talk about when they highlight the teachers in this documentary, there are no black teachers.
Wow.
The teachers that they highlight of having success, there are not black teachers. And so I want to underscore that we believe black teachers are key to this work.
Mm.
Not, you know, we need teachers of all ethnicities, gender, et cetera. We want to make sure they're competent.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. And I do want to highlight that. And I also want to just underscore that some people walk away believing that the NAACP the theory of change is if we just do this phonics-based instruction, then we're going to change things. That's absolutely not the case. There is no one thing that's going to fix this challenge. So there are multiple things, like I've talked about during this conversation, that are going to move the needle forward. And I also will say that every city is going to come up with their own kind of set of expectations, set of demands, set of asks. And so we're not walking in lockstep. Hmm. Nobody tells St. Louis how to St. Louis.
Right.
So wow. I just want to make sure that I emphasize that.
I'm glad you did, because if I'm looking at that, which I'm already registered, and I saw that, I was going to be texting you right where while I'm watching it. So thanks for that heads up. Thank you, Ian Buchanan, for joining us today to talk about the right to read. You can get involved in that by, you know, joining up and finding out what's going on. Next week, we will have Keisha Akers, the mother of Alex Bell, on the show. And I think there's one more announcement for the Black and Green event coming up on February 7th on food and health. You can check that out by calling 727-8540. Thank you for joining. This is Jamala Rogers. I'll see you on the battlefield.